Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So, ready or not, here we come. That's what Melanie said just as before I started.
Yeah.
Did we mention about the mildew problem, the mold?
I don't know.
So, our house has had occasionally, in different places even, problems with mildew or mold growing. And we've dealt with it as it came up. It's an old house. It's had leaks in various places. And one of the worst parts was in the girls' room. There's this corner of the room, which is at the corner of the house, which is behind a bookcase, right?
There's a bookcase there, and it's always damp.
Always damp.
And along behind, all along the whole wall, but especially in that corner, like, the baseboards have a tendency to grow mold.
It's gross.
It's really gross.
It's bad. And it's gotten really bad this winter. The room just smelled of mildew, and it's not good for the girls. It's not good for anybody, especially because Bella has asthma. I mean, and then the rooms, the windows of the room always had condensation. And whenever we cook, like if we make pasta or soup or something, all the windows of the house would be just covered in
wet.
And so,
and the windowsill in the living room, where we tend to kind of leave piles of books for homeschooling, tends to get damp, and like the books start to get wet
and mildew. And
yuck. It's
been a problem. And so for a long time, I thought that the problem in the girls' room was there's a leak in the eave on the outside, which seemed like a huge thing to deal with. And so I hadn't dealt with it yet and was going to wait for the spring. But for whatever reason, we decided, well, let's try a dehumidifier.
Well, because I went on Facebook and said, I'm really, really distressed. And several friends said, hey, have you tried a dehumidifier?
Right. Finally, I said, let's try it. I went online. I went to the Wirecutter, where I always go. That's the new Consumer Reports, the Wirecutter. I looked up their recommendation, and I grabbed their recommendation for, not the top one, because the top one's like a basement one with hoses and pumps and stuff like that. We don't need that in the girls' room. But I grabbed the recommendation. Finally came this week and set it up. And so the first night was a problem because it was so... What I forgot was while it's dehumidifying, it's running at high speed, especially in the beginning as it's trying to get all the moisture out, and it's pumping out heat. It was a little heat pump, and there, the girls' room in the winter tends to be the warmest room. It's where most of the heat comes. We have forced hot air, so the heat comes to their room first. And so poor Bella in the morning was crying because she couldn't sleep with all the heat. It was too warm.
Mm-hmm.
Poor thing. But it pulled so much moisture out of the air. It was like 80% humidity in there when we started. Like the thermostat in the hall, what you said? It was like
60 something percent.
60, which is still it's not huge, but it's still relatively high. So we put it in there, and so it starts at like high speed for the first day, and then after a few days you're supposed to lower. But it made a huge difference within 24 hours. It was a very different room. And it filled up this big thing of water, the big reservoir, which I had to dump within 24 hours. And then I dumped another one the next day. Like, it was a lot of water. And, like, we've been cooking and stuff, and the girls have been saying there's no condensation. There's no condensation on their walls, on the windows. And we're even noticing in other parts of the house where there's no condensation.
Right, I've noticed that, like, usually when we boil water or take a shower, like, the windows start to fog up.
All over the house. Yeah.
And I've noticed a lot less. And even like in the bathroom, like when someone takes a shower, the window will fog up sort of immediately. But then within like half an hour, it's dry again.
Now. Yeah.
Now.
But whereas before
it would be all day.
Yeah, and we'd run the vent in the bathroom trying to vent it out, but that wouldn't do it.
The fan was just not enough.
Yeah. So, gosh, it's one of those situations where I wish we'd done it so far long ago. You know, just we'd done it before, but it's
really nice. Yeah. I feel like the whole house feels just less damp and unpleasant.
Yes. Totally. It is much less of a smell. Now we still get to take the stuff out of the corner, take the bookcase off the wall, and paint it with Kills. We need to
now that it's dry and we can be sure that it's going to like stay dry.
Right, because we've painted it before with the Kills. That's the primer you put down that you put over, you know, anything moldy or anything antibacterial, you know, I mean anti-mildew sort of paint, but. Yeah, we've done that once before, and it didn't stop it because it kept getting mildewy.
It slowed it down, but didn't stop it.
You had to dry it out. So, I think we're in a good place with it. So, one of the fun things is I told the girls was, it's not a dehumidifier, it's a moisture evaporator, like from Star Wars on Tatooine, like at Luke had to go fix.
Because Luke's aunt and uncle run a moisture farm.
Right. It works on the same principle. It pulls moisture out of the air so that they can give it to their plants, right? So I told them it's a moisture evaporator, and they're now moisture farmers, and they like that. That was, I think that was very popular among them. So dehumidifier, yay! It's the small things in life that really...
You know you're a grown-up. You know you're old when you get really excited about things like dehumidifiers.
Dehumidifier.
But it's true.
It's funny because a lot of people in the winter, they put out humidifiers because the heating system makes the house so dry.
Well, and in fact, in the past, when we've had children with asthma problems and I've taken them to the pediatrician or talked to the pharmacist, they've said, you know, you should try running a humidifier in their room. And I kind of look at them in horror. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Our windowsills are growing black mildew stuff. I don't want to add more moisture to the air. So I think this will actually be a significant improvement.
Yes, I think so. I'm very pleased with it. So there's that. So another thing I wanted to mention was this week, COVID came closer to home, not in our home. Thank God, and knock on wood, nobody in our family, in our immediate family in our house, but members of my extended family, fairly close, have come down with it. And it's concerning, of course. I mean, not just because they have it, and at least one of them has other conditions that could make it even more dangerous, but also because of my mom, who's 82, and my dad, who's 88, who have been around with or live with, or, you know, people. And so it's very concerning. So, say your prayers, but if you say prayers for them and for, I mean, there's so many people who need, I mean, I was just seeing Greg Willits from, you know, a friend from one of the founders of SQPN, had just mentioned online in public that he'd been suffering with it for a few weeks. And Father Roderick, one of the other co-founders of SQPN, he'd had it in the fall. This surge is really getting a lot of people. So just concerning. And we're trying our best to stay safe. I mean, I know people who are being more strict than we are and people who are being less strict, but we're kind of in the middle. So, yeah. Anyway, just thought I'd mention. The other thing that we did, speaking of things that are less strict, we're still doing scouts. And we had the girls had a scout merit badge night. So Ben and his scout troop is going to earn the plumbing merit badge, which I think is awesome.
Plumbing is awesome. You know, he's going to be able to fix all of our sink problems.
Yes. Well, you know what? Hey, maybe he'll find it interesting and want to maybe investigate becoming a plumber by trade. That is a great profession.
You can make a lot of money as a plumber.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you talk to plumbers, they cannot find apprentices. They can't get young people, young guys or girls, young women to go into the profession. And it's like a ton of money in it. They're turning down jobs because they can't do enough of it. There aren't enough plumbers. So I would love it if he did that. But the other thing that the girls troop is doing, one of the required merit badges to get Eagle Scout is cooking. And so they're doing their cooking merit badge. And Ben asked if he could do it along with them. So he went to their troop meeting this week, and that was kind of fun. They were, I'm a merit badge counselor for cooking, so and they were learning about, you know, food safety, food, how to read food labels and nutrition, but they also have to cook, obviously. And this time they made pancakes. Now, let's be clear. They didn't make pancakes like my recipe. They made pancakes out of a mix. You know, here's some pancake mix, here's some water, and I don't know, maybe some milk or an egg or something like that, at most. But it's they get it, baby steps. So they all of the scouts each made a couple pancakes, and they did it themselves. They mix it up, they put it on the griddle, they flip it. Ben had a little trouble on the flip. His kind of like went blah, like it was a little deformed, but the second one was much better. And then they got to eat their pancakes at the end. I'm very enthusiastic about them learning the cooking merit badge. And in fact, Ben, I was inspired to do, we haven't been able to have pancakes after mass because of the new mass schedule for a long time. So I said, let's do pancakes for dinner. So we had pancakes for dinner the other night, and Ben wanted to help. And he did. He did a lot of the work. Got a little distracted about 3/4 of the way through, disappeared when half the pancakes had been cooked or so. But, you know, that was fine.
Well, our family eats a lot of pancakes, so that was a big batch of pancakes.
Right. And you made some pancakes for Lucy, some new pancakes.
I did. Now that she can have milk and eggs, it was time to revisit pancakes. Like, I had tried to make her some, like, vegan pancakes early on, and they just weren't all that good. I mean, when you have to make gluten-free and
dairy-free
and egg-free,
there's not a lot right. left.
So they were okay. She kind of liked them, but they were a real pain to make as well. So I made some. She said they were interesting, and she...
It's her favorite word with new food.
Yeah, she ate one, and then kind of we put the rest in a bag. So I'm not sure. I may end up giving them to the other kids.
They weren't very... The batter, like it wasn't a batter, like a pancake batter. It was a dough. It was really thick.
It was very doughy.
Yeah.
I need to, the trick is that for a lot of... I prefer, like, almond flour to the pre-made gluten...
The mixes.
Mixes. Like, I just find a lot of the mixes use, like, rice flour, which I think is kind of gritty. And, but the ones that use almond flour tend to be, like, the paleo, so then they're substituting, like, almond milk, and they're trying to avoid sugar, so they're using applesauce and agave nectar and all sorts of weird things, and it's very hard to find a recipe that's just...
A normal recipe. that just substitutes wheat flour for almond flour for wheat flour.
Right. So there's just a sort of, I don't know. Anyway, it was okay. What she was more happy about was today after mass, I made some scrambled eggs with onion and mushroom and potato and cheese. And she ate a huge helping of those. I put corn tortilla strips in
basically migas
in everybody else's, yeah. But Lucy still can't eat corn, so she had the
everything else, the egg mixture,
everything but the egg version, everything but the corn version. Yes, I can't talk. And she was a huge fan of that, so
good.
It's nice to see that she's this week. We also revisited oatmeal with just regular milk. I had tried her on oatmeal with soy milk ages ago, and she liked it okay, but again, it was kind of
interesting.
Well, it also, like, if I make it with regular milk and she only eats like half bowl,
then you waste the rest of it, or you have to eat
If I make it with regular milk and she eats a half bowl, yeah, I will eat the rest of it. If I make it with like weird soy milk and she eats a half bowl, I don't really want to eat the rest of the oatmeal made with soy milk. So
it's a parent's duty to eat the rest of the children's food.
Whereas I love oatmeal. It's one of my favorite breakfasts. So basically, I was making oatmeal for myself and letting her try it, which is much more.
That's much more doable.
Yeah.
Much more frugal. Okay, so let's talk about some other food that we've been making this week. We made an interesting curry this week.
This curry was, I I thought, like something I would expect to order at a restaurant. I was really pleased with the way it came out.
Yes, it was a coconut shrimp curry.
Right. I have been, like for more than a week, 2 weeks maybe, I've been, like, really thinking about fixating on coconut lime juice as, like, a flavor combo.
Yes. Which is a great curry flavor combo.
Yeah. And I was thinking kind of soup, but then we had the shrimp, and you suggested curry, and it just sort of, like, all came together as a coconut curry.
It's right. It started as with the shrimp. Like, what do we get in the freezer? And as I've said before, if shrimp is on sale,
you'll buy it. Right.
And it's been on sale because after the holidays. So we had some in the freezer, and so it was, what do we want to do? Well, at first I was thinking like coconut shrimp, like popcorn shrimp, like fried.
It was way too late in the evening to try to do that. Yeah.
Right. It was pre-cooked shrimp.
Yeah. You can't do coconut. You can't do a breading on a pre-cooked shrimp.
Yeah. You can't raw fry it. Yeah. It would overcook it. We'll come back to that at some other point. But
I want to try coconut shrimp though.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
I looked at some of the recipes and they looked pretty good. Although some of them use sweetened coconut and it just seems wrong to me.
Why?
No, unsweetened coconut flakes.
Okay. No, because you want it to have that sort of sweet quality to it.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about it. although maybe unsweetened coconut and honey. Anyway, sorry. It's the cooking thing in the head, you know. And I want to want to start planning out a recipe. So the coconut shrimp curry. Yeah. So it was really good. So we had the shrimp. It was pre-cooked shrimp. Really. So that makes it really easy. We had mushrooms. One of the things I've decided with putting mushrooms into soups and to curries and things is I realized slices are too small. I like the meatiness of quarter or if they're really big, you know, cut them into chunks. But chunked mushrooms in a curry or in a stew or a soup as opposed to sliced. It seems a fine distinction, I know.
That seems really kind of finicky to me, but if you prefer it that way, I don't have a strong preference either way.
I like a mushroom with some bite, you know, some heft. Okay, so, sorry, I'm all right. Very finicky with that. So what else was in it?
We had carrots and bell peppers, some red bell peppers and onions. And the fun ingredient was we had half a head of Napa cabbage, I would not normally put in a curry, but it worked.
Yes.
I really, really liked it.
We had the other half of the Napa cabbage was in a stir fry we did.
Which was okay. But the sauce kind of needed some oomph that it didn't have.
Right. But as far as the cabbage worked really well. I think Napa I'm liking Napa cabbage.
My new favorite ingredient is Napa cabbage. I'm like, buy some more of that. I want to try some more things.
Yes. So we're going to, we had that in it. And then of course there's those tomato, and ginger.
Yeah. We used some of the fire roasted tomatoes.
Yeah. Canned
like it
fire
wasn't
roasted
a
tomato.
Super tomato-y, but it had some tomato in it, which I liked.
Obviously the lemon juice. And then for the curry powder, all right, so I'm going to mention this. We have a sponsor for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Colchester Curry House, okay? And this is not a paid sponsor for this episode. I'm not saying this because he's a sponsor, but I ordered some curry powder from him, curry spices, you know, the mixes from him to try them out when he wanted to be a sponsor. And so... we're really grateful for him sponsoring it. And if you want to support a Catholic curry house, you know, this guy from India who's selling his mom's curry spice mixes, you know,
this was
really good.
It was really, really good. Now, it was also pretty hot on the hot scale.
Especially for the kids.
It was too, well, Anthony and Sophie, who like hot foods,
were okay.
Gobbled it down. Lucy said it was too hot for her, and she'll usually eat one of my curries where I've held back on the heat a little bit.
When it's bland. I always add more spice to mine.
Well.
And Bella and Ben never eat curry.
Yeah. They had mac and cheese.
They had mac and cheese. Right. That's just a given. But it was I didn't think it was especially spicy, but they're very sensitive to it. So if you're someone who is afraid of spiciness, I wouldn't worry about it too much. It had a little bit of a kick, but not like a wow, that's my mouth is burning sort of thing.
I thought my mouth was kind of hurting.
Okay.
You're not the best judge of this.
I suppose. I guess I've been desensitized.
Yeah, you...
So
yeah.
This was the... I think he called it this Earth Tones Masala.
It was really, really flavorful. Yes. I liked it a lot.
Yes. We have to order more because we used it all up. But he's got several different mixes, like chicken, you know, one intended for chicken, one for beef, different... It was very good. It was so good. It was so good. So, like you said, this could have been a restaurant dish. It was really good. And we served it over the jasmine rice, which I think worked really well.
Yeah, it was yum.
It was good. So
I wanted more.
Yes. Yeah, we'll have to make it again. So the other thing we, cooking-related thing this week was we've decided that our faithful old Dutch oven had seen its best days.
Old orange, sadly.
So I'll tell you a little about this. This Dutch oven was 15 years old. It's a Dutch oven as in it's cast iron.
And enameled.
Dutch oven, right.
Yeah.
It's orange. And it's orange because it's Mario Batali branded. Do you remember Mario Batali, who has now been canceled, sadly, because I really enjoyed his shows and his cooking. And I obviously what he did, you can look it up, whatever. But it was branded Mario Batali. And we bought it when we were first married, and it was like $60. And it was a 6-quart. Dutch oven. And
when we were married, 6-quart seems like...
Oh, that was huge.
Gigantic.
Two of us, we're not going to have 6 quarts of food. Yet now it's like when we'd make a pot of soup, we'd have to fill it all the way up and we'd run out of soup. It was always not...
What can we serve beside the soup to make sure the kids have enough to fill their bellies?
Yeah. And so we wanted a bigger Dutch oven. And this one had become all... stained, which is fine. I don't worry about the look, but it had started to chip. The enamel had started to chip.
Yeah, it had chipped not just on the sides, but down in the bottom of the pot, too.
Right, and then that means the cast iron is getting exposed and rusting and whatever and all that, leaching out. So,
well, leaching is not a problem. Right,
but the rust, I don't want the rust. Especially with the tomato-y stuff that we cook in it.
Yeah.
The acid would really eat away at it. So... we wanted to get a new Dutch oven. We weren't going to find one for $60, and we wanted one that was bigger. And everyone's like, oh, the Le Creuset is the best. And I'm like,
it is the best. It's also way out of our price range.
Priced like the best, especially the big ones that we wanted to get. Like a 6-quart was like $280. So it was like, I mean, if you can afford it, that's, I would love to get one. They're fantastic. But, that wasn't for us. But, Lodge, the famous makers of cast iron skillets, you know, mm-hmm. they've expanded their line into other areas, including porcelain and enameled stuff. So they had a 7.5-quart Dutch oven. I was kind of hoping to get like an 8 or 9-quart.
That would have been nice.
But as I think about it, that would be wicked heavy.
Well, there's that.
It would be really heavy to maneuver that around. And we have a glass top stove. I worry about that. So we ended up getting the 7.5-quart. It was a beautiful blue color.
I really like the blue.
Yeah.
Orange is not my favorite color.
Yes. I mean, it worked. It was fine.
It was okay. It
wasn't as orange as it used to be with all the stains on the outside.
That is true. It was definitely more of a...
brown.
Yeah.
It was more brown, which is fine. It means it's loved. And we've cooked so many meals in that Dutch oven.
I'm kind of like reluctant to get rid of it because I just have this weird sentimental attachment to it after so many years.
We've cooked maybe at least 2 meals a week in that Dutch oven for 15 years. Probably, and many,
that's a lot of
weeks,
meals.
Many more. Right. So, yeah, it's seen everything in that Dutch oven. I mean, I have a picture of me holding Bella while I'm stirring. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Little baby. You know, so, yeah, there, you get some sentimental attachment to these things. But we used the new Dutch oven tonight when we made the Asian noodle soup that we do. And that was...
It was nice to have plenty of soup.
It was full right up to the top. And, yeah, there was enough for everyone to have enough and feel full. And there was a little left over. That doesn't often happen with the Asian noodle soup.
We've stopped having leftovers for that dish.
Yeah, so it was nice. So really happy with it and reasonably priced. I think it was still on sale when I got it. It was on sale. I was ordering it. I think I still did get it on sale around $110, $120, something like that. The Trump bucks paid for it. The stimulus paid for that. So it was really nice to get that. So very happy with it. Hopefully many more meals to come.
Right.
Well, that now that I think about it, in 10 years, starting 10 years, it's going to be fewer people. We're going to be looking for a smaller Dutch oven at some point.
Nah, we'll just give it to the boys when they move out.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. These boys are about to become teenagers. We're going to need two Dutch ovens.
I know. I'm all concerned.
Yes, yes, I know. They're going to start eating us out of house and home. They have to get jobs to pay for their food. That's why they're homeschooled. He'll be a plumber. He'll pay for it. So that's the food. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about this other thing that came up this week, this interesting phenomenon that you kind of stumbled on called Sea Shanty TikTok.
Yeah, I think I stumbled. Somebody on Facebook shared
an article.
No, it was like they shared a video. Like,
oh, okay.
Look at this cool thing. And then like a article that went with it. Or maybe it was an article. I don't even remember how I stumbled upon it, really.
How do these things ever show up in your home?
I don't know. These you and then you go down the rabbit hole looking for more and more of the thing. And so then, like, yeah. Anyway, TikTok sea shanties. I love sea shanties. We play sea shanties. We sing them while we're, like, eating dinner or cooking, cleaning up after dinner.
Whenever we have roast beef, we sing Roast Beef of Old England.
Yes. That's pretty much the soundtrack if we're having roast beef. That the sea shanties are sort of the de rigueur dinner time soundtrack. Yeah. Anyway, the fun thing was that this introduced me to a sea shanty I hadn't heard before, the Wellerman, which evidently has gone viral on TikTok, where TikTok has this feature. I've never used TikTok, so I am just describing what I've like seen. But it has a feature that lets you do a duet, like you play somebody else's video and then sing along.
Right.
Right. So evidently you can layer that then, and then you can play the one where the guy's singing along. And then you singing along, too. And then somebody else can take that and sing along with that.
And they two friends and they two friends and so on and so
right.
on.
And so you get these like beautiful layered sounds where you have a whole group of people singing the sea shanty. And it's
so it apparently started with a Scotsman, right? The Scottish musician. That's where people have detected the origin of this, at least the Wellerman. In this video, you're seeing the Scotsman was first, and then there was this other guy with a basso profundo.
Oh my gosh,
he has such a deep bass. And then all these other people come in, and then there's a woman with a violin at one point, and yeah.
So we started watching them, and then we, of course, like went to iTunes and found a bunch of the various sea shanties. And then that led us down a whole rabbit hole of I actually found an article that suggested that the Jewish traditional singing Niganim.
Yeah. Niganim.
Yeah. Could be the next, like they were proposing this as the next TikTok phenomenon. It hasn't happened yet, but they kind of want it to. But what I really liked was several articles that I read that were talking about sort of why this phenomenon might have occurred and kind of thinking about like the nature of sea shanty as a communal singing, especially right. for like,
especially for people who aren't very good at singing.
Right. I mean, they were work songs for sailors and, you know, to keep a beat while they're hauling up sails or turning the capstan or whatever the sailors are doing.
Doing sailory things.
Doing sailory things, right? So they're work songs, which means you've got one person singing the verses and then everybody chimes in on the chorus, and the chorus is where you're actually like hauling on the ropes. And they're really easy to pick up. You listen to a sea shanty once and you're, by the end of the, like, the first time you're listening to it, you're singing along on the chorus. It doesn't take a lot to learn how to sing them.
Right.
Which is fun.
Yes.
And
which is why all the kids can sing along.
And they're fun to sing to. They're right. so fun. And we had the kids like working and like doing like work parties, cleaning up the house, singing sea shanties.
So I distracted you. So the reason why it was big now is,
well, partly we're all really longing for connection. People on lockdown, quarantine, staying home, working from home. We're all kind of low on connection, and there's something really visceral about singing together. I mean, we singing in church, singing for work songs, just, there's something people incredibly...
singing in arenas, like, or at games, like at baseball games or football games, people singing in the stands.
Oh yeah. My gosh, yeah. So anyway, like, just listening to, like, there was one sea shanty where there was, like, a whole screen full, like, 100 people singing along to it.
Right, right.
I was crying. Like, there were tears running down my face just watching 100 people singing together on a video screen.
Like all separate. Like, all these people in separate places.
In separate places, in their homes. But
all over the world.
All over the world. And yet, joined together, making beautiful music. There's something incredible spiritual about that.
Like, yes.
The connection. This is the kind of connection that we're made for. We're made to connect, to be together, to join in making something beautiful in the world. And I think this sea shanties are sort of emblematic of that.
I think the next big thing is not going to be the Jewish one. It's going to be the Viking chant.
I think that's kind of a subset of sea shanty, like the rowing song.
I think it's maybe like predates the sea shanty we know of because it's older, like the Viking raiders.
Right, right. But it's, they're all sort of work music, like songs, yes, that you work to.
That's right.
A friend of mine actually shared some videos with me of voyageur songs. So the voyageurs were the French settlers in Canada, like the guys who went up and down the rivers.
The trappers and stuff, yeah.
Trapping and trading with the native peoples. And the voyageur songs that she shared were really awesome. They kind of had a very Irish music sort of
Celtic
sensibility. Yeah.
French Celtic.
Yeah. I mean, I am a huge fan of Irish music. Like, I was the groupie with the Irish band when I was in college. So that's kind of one of my touchstones for music. So, yeah.
You're the girl who backpacked around Ireland by herself.
I did. I did. I went to Irish pubs by myself and had guys buying me Guinness and also Red Bull and vodka, which is kind of gross, but I tried it.
That's very Irish.
Those were Irish work roofers.
Yes.
Pretty American girl. Let's buy her drinks.
So the sea shanty thing is really one of the things that with the group who did the video with 100 people. They also had another.
Was that the Longest Johns?
The Longest Johns, yes.
I really like them.
Yeah, they're like, that's their shtick. They are a sea shanty band. Like, who knew? It's their time. Now is the time for them.
There are a bunch of sea shanty bands out there. I found another one whose...
Their tagline?
Their tagline was...
The original...
Buoy band.
Buoy band.
Buoy band. I love it. So... Anyway,
the Long Johns, they do this thing...
Longest Johns.
Longest Johns. They did this thing. There's a video game, like a multiplayer video game that you can play of where it's a pirate ship, and you can talk to your avatar. You can talk through them to other people, like this audio chat. And so what they did was they started playing, and they would all be present, and they would all like start singing the sea shanties. They were a professional band, like sea shanty band, and they'd start singing, and the other players would be like, "Whoa, that's awesome, dude!" It was like their reactions were priceless. It was awesome. You know the reaction I really love with the two black guys in the car, like the brothers?
Uh-huh.
Like the one brother is like, dude, you got to hear this new thing on TikTok.
And he starts singing along, and his brother who's driving the car just gives him this look like
what is wrong with you,
what,
dude?
What insanity is this? And then as it goes on, though, you see him kind of like...
His expression changes.
He kind of gets into it, and he starts to kind of like bob his head to the beat, and then he's like joining in on the chorus, and then he's like
by the end, he's all in.
Like just belting it out and then doing harmonies, and it was glorious.
Because the connection between the sea shanties and the Negro spirituals and hip-hop and all of those things, they're not disconnected. There are connections, deep connections between all these things.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend who actually teaches a college course in African American music, and she was really all over the whole phenomenon. It was so fun.
So you can tell we're kind of sea shanty. We've been like, I have a playlist of 150 songs in Apple Music of sea shanty music that predates this, by the way. We've been sea shanty nerds for a while, so
it kind of goes along with the whole like Swallows and Amazons and
our membership to Mystic Seaport and the fact that my favorite thing in Boston is the USS Constitution,
right? this
is deep rooted.
Actually, early on in our marriage, I think, or maybe even when we were still dating, we did a reread of Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey and Mataran series.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also like full of all sorts it's of great nautical. Nautical it's
Age music. Of Sail. Yeah. So yeah, this hits home for us. So as you can tell. All right. So let's move on to what we've been reading or watching.
Well, that was kind of what one of the things we've been watching
and listening. Yes. So yeah, a couple of things. I'm still working through my book. Excuse me.
Which book is this again?
This is the Rhythm of War in the Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson.
Brandon Sanderson.
And his books are, they're long. They're good, but they're long. And I always kind of save them for this time of year as a, like from the end of December to January for my Goodreads challenge. So it doesn't set me back too far. So I can start it after I've completed my Goodreads challenge in the previous year.
Does it really matter? I mean, it's a year is a year.
No. So if I don't like, if I start it in 2020, then I'm like a third of the way through. If I start it in 2021, it crowds out the all the ones that would come after it into 2021. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but if you had read it, but like you're going to read it sometime during the year. What does it matter if it's the beginning of the year or the end of the year? It's the same year.
No, it's not the same year. It's overlapping. It's taking up a shorter part of 2021. Than it would if I started it in 2021.
Oh, you mean you started it in 2020?
Yes.
After you'd already hit your goal for the 2020.
Exactly.
So that you're not...
Excess capacity in 2020 helps me get a jump on 2021.
That seems like cheating.
It is not cheating.
It's totally cheating.
It is totally within the rules.
Okay, whatever. I don't officially do reading challenges, although I keep count, or I try to. I'm really bad at keeping track. I try to keep track of...
Of what you read.
What I read over the course of a year.
Since I read everything on Kindle, everything shows up on Goodreads automatically anyway for me. And I find that having this number that I'm trying to reach, it hits something in my, you know, in my hippocampus or whatever and gets me.
It gamifies it.
It gamifies it and motivates me. I read more. I love to read, but things end up crowding it out. Before I did this, I was reading a lot less because stuff was crowding out my reading time. So now I'm back to reading a lot.
I don't really understand the whole idea of things crowding out reading time because, like, to me, reading time is like...
Well, you don't do, like, seven different podcasts about a bunch of different shows and movies that you have to watch.
Well, this is one reason why I don't, because it would crowd into my reading time.
Well, I'm taking one for the team. This is the job. Anyway.
Right.
Speaking of watching things, I did watch two things unrelated to other work stuff, which is... both on Disney Plus, both Marvel. There's a new series called WandaVision. It's the first Disney Plus Marvel series. There have been a few other things, but this is one of the big MCU products. Okay.
I kind of wanted to. I thought that looked like it might be something I might want to watch, but I wasn't sure if I needed to catch up.
Yeah, you need to
catch on up. A bunch of Marvel movies before
you
watched it.
You gotta catch up on all the Marvel movies.
See,
like you have to at least have seen Age of Ultron.
Yeah, which I haven't.
Which you haven't, because both of these characters don't show up until Age of Ultron, so it wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
Now, I'll try to do this so as not to spoil you.
Please.
But the premise is a kind of a weird premise, which is, like, Vision is an AI who's taken corporeal form. He's a physical form, but he's not a person. He's a machine, sort of. He's a construct, but he has AI and a full personality and all that stuff. Wanda is Scarlet Witch. She has these, you know, magical powers. Let's call them magical powers. And they're in love. Okay. That's been established in the movies. Okay.
Okay.
So this one picks up, they are in a sitcom, a 60s version of sort of Bewitched and Dick Van Dyke Show.
Okay.
You know, and they're going through all of these, like, it's very much like typical situation comedy of the 60s where you have, oh, the boss and his wife are coming for dinner and, oh, you know, we've had a miscommunication and you think it's a romantic dinner. So you've prepared for a romantic dinner and now the boss is here and, oh, this is awkward because you did all these things. Or, you know what I mean? So it's very.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like an episode of I Love Lucy.
Exactly. And you're like going, why are we? But they have all their powers, like, and he can disguise himself so he looks human, but you as a viewer of this, as a fan of Marvel, you know, you're going, why are they doing this? This is very, why, like, what was the point of the show? And as you get to the end of the first episode, it kind of pulls back, and now it's, no, you're actually watching this on a TV in some kind of control room, but it doesn't show you anything. It doesn't tell you anything. And the second episode, there's several more hints that there's more going on here. Like, it's in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wanda starts noticing things in color that really stand out.
Sounds Wizard of Oz-ish.
Well, yeah, and there's something more going on than just this, hey, wouldn't it be wacky and funny if Wanda and Vision were in a situation comedy from the 60s? Something deeper is going on.
Interesting.
Yeah, so...
That sounds like the kind of story I could get behind.
And it's the sort of thing you could only really do on a streaming service like this. Like, they drop the first two episodes at once because you really need the two episodes to pull you in. Because otherwise you're thinking, well, this is weird. Like, what's going on? This is kind of dumb. But no, there's more. So it pulls you in.
But only two episodes. So, like, you have to wait for the next.
Yes. Disney is doing like they do a Mandalorian, which is week by week.
I see.
The other thing I watched, not nearly mm-hmm. as good.
What was that?
All right. So there have been two Fantastic Four movies. There was the 2005 Fantastic Four.
Okay.
With Chris Evans, Jessica Alba, the guy who was Horatio Hornblower.
Owen Griffith?
Yeah, the guy with the Welsh name with all the vowels and consonants. Yeah. And Michael Chiklis as the Thing.
Okay.
Ben Grimm. Okay. That was a good movie, 2005. They remade the movie in 2015
all
with
right.
a new cast. Kate Mara plays Sue Storm, and the only other actor you probably recognize is there was a guy from Turn. Remember the Revolutionary War series Turn?
Uh-huh.
And
that was a long time ago.
Abraham Woodhull. He was the spy, the guy who was the farmer who became the spy. So the actor who played that was Ben Grimm. And then Michael B. Jordan from Black Panther. He was Killmonger. He plays Human Torch. Okay.
Okay.
So they remade it. And I was kind of like, why do they remake this? It's just 10 years. And I think maybe they remade it because they wanted to make Fantastic Four part of the whole MCU.
So they're rebooting it in order to sort of incorporate it and do more with the characters and stuff?
Well, also because they have a problem, because Chris Evans was the Human Torch in 2005, but now he's Captain America.
That could be a problem, right?
No, you could just recast it. They could have just recast it.
Right.
But they probably also didn't have Jessica Alba and Ewan Griffith and Ben Chiklis under contract to do movies either. Although, if they're smart, they'd want to be in the MCU, but... You know, who knows?
Maybe they're busy.
Maybe they're busy. So they remade it, and it was bad. So the movie is about an hour and 45 minutes. And I knew going into it that it wouldn't be that good, but I heard people talk about it. But it's an hour and 45 minutes. They don't get their superpowers for 45 minutes.
Wow.
It was way too long. There was way too much buildup, way too much. Like, oh my gosh. And then once they get the superpowers, they don't really do much with it. There's like one event really associated with it. The baddie that they have to battle. But that's about it. There's no exploration of the thing, of the superpowers like that you usually have. They just drop the whole middle part of every superhero origin movie. Like, there's always this big part of a superhero origin movie where you have to explore your powers.
Right. You got to figure out, what can I do? What does this mean for me? Like, both the emotional and the sort of just practical, like, what can I do? Can I walk on walls? Can I fly? Can I see through things? Like, right.
Right. And maybe they thought, well, that's been done in every other superhero movie. We're not going to do that in this one. We're going to do something different.
But I think there's an emotional need for that.
There is. There's a reason that's a part of superhero origin movies, that you need to have this moment where the hero discovers the call to the quest. Superhero movies are bigger than just superhero movies. They're connected to the huge human story of the hero's call to the quest.
Right. Like, I mean, that's part of, like, gosh, like any like Disney animated movie, even there's like,
right.
there's the song, like there's always a song, the call, exactly. The sea, it calls me.
Right.
I want to be up where the people are.
Right. Exactly.
There must be something more than this provincial life.
Right.
Right. Like the call, you got to have it.
Now there is a bit of a like, oh, I want to, you know, what do you want to do with your life? You just want to be famous? No, I want to make a difference in the world. And that was about it. Like, okay.
That's nice. So,
nice to hear. And then it was, you know, evil corporate jerks who'd get their comeuppance and, you know. Just, but it wasn't like, and there's even like the initial internal conflict between the team is sort of like, oh, how could you do this to me? Oh, I'm sorry. All right. And it's like, well, okay, I guess we're over that.
I mean, on a human level, it's kind of nice when people can, like, apologize and make up, but I suppose that doesn't really drive a story very well.
They didn't really make up. It just kind of moved on. yeah, I know, it was really bad. Okay, but we're really going to take care of this first. Okay, we'll put a pin in that, come back to it? Sure.
Never came back to it.
like, everything's all better now. Like, suddenly something happened off screen or something. I don't know. It was a frustrating movie. Especially so, since what it means is because you've done this, you've probably killed the franchise of Fantastic Four, or maybe not. Maybe Disney is going to say, we need to make this work. Hopefully they won't reboot it again. This is like Spider-Man. Spider-Man has been rebooted 3 times. I think we're done with that.
But I think that even like with a weak start, you could conceivably
just do another movie
and just make it a really good one, and that could save
and
a franchise.
You don't have to show the origin of the Fantastic Four again. Like, we're done with that part. Let's just move on. And even if you have to recast it, because you'd have to recast it because Michael B. Jordan as the Human Torch, he was Killmonger. So, but even if you recast it, just move on. Just move on to a new story. Anyway, so yeah, Fantastic Four. That's the great thing about having these services. Now I didn't like it. It's there. Just watch it. It's there. I can watch
it. There's no, you have to pay to rent it.
Very low opportunity cost.
Yeah.
So did you have anything else you want to talk about in this section?
Let's see. I haven't talked about anything really.
I know. Well, that came up actually as we were preparing. It's like, what have you watched or read?
Well, I am 50% of the way through a novel, called Laurus, and I cannot remember the, it's by a Russian novelist. It's a contemporary Russian novel, but it's a historical novel. So written within the past few years,
Russian history.
But it's set in medieval Russia. And I really, really, really like it.
What's it called?
Laurus, Laurus.
Okay.
It moves very slowly at first. Like the first quarter of the book, I felt like was just kind of like, I had a recommendation from a friend whose literary tastes I really trust, and so I was going to push through it, but it kind of felt like the first quarter of The Brothers Karamazov, which just moves really slowly.
Russian books.
They just go fast. It actually feels a lot like Dostoevsky, but if Dostoevsky was a modern novelist as opposed to a 19th century novelist.
Yep.
Because it's got this great Russian sensibility, including the spiritual sensibility, because it's set in the Middle Ages. These are people who have faith. And the main character, especially, is a man who wrestles with faith, is, I suppose, the best way to put it. He actually goes crazy at one point and he becomes a holy fool for some indeterminate period of time, because at that point he's not really paying attention to time. And there's a certain Russian type, like it's a sort of a archetype of the holy fool who has true, like he acts kind of like a crazy person. Like he's living in a cemetery attached to a convent and like doesn't bathe and just sort of begs for food and is kind of insane. Like he strips naked and lets the mosquitoes bite him and things like that. But he also has a deep wisdom and insight, and he's working at atoning for a sin. And so there's this great idea of atonement and of relationship with God, with other people. And now he's actually off on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, which is really great. I love exploring, sort of wandering across the vast tracts of space in a historical time to really see what is the world like at this time in space. Because it's a modern novel, we also have like these awareness that time is kind of fluid and it's not fixed, and that we experience time because of our human limitations. But of course, to God, all time is eternally present. And so the characters have these moments where they kind of slip through time, and the narrator himself likes to pop in and out of the story with like these totally anachronistic details. At one point, our main character is wandering through the woods and something is described as being like yellow or green, like plastic bottles.
Right.
And it both kind of throws you out of it, the story, but and yet at the same time, it's thematically appropriate because it really is about this awareness of the importance of time, our relationship with time and the eternal. I don't know where the novel is going at all, but I'm really enjoying the ride.
You wrote halfway through, just like I'm halfway through my book.
Yeah. I'll probably finish mine before you finish yours.
You will finish yours before you finish mine. Yes, I know that's a given. All right, let's move on to talk about this week's mass readings. Because as we talk about this, it's the second Sunday in Ordinary Time, and the first reading was that famous one about Samuel when he was 12 in the temple and sleeping. Well, Father kept saying he was probably about 12 years old.
Thought I was awake during the homily, but I don't remember anything about him being 12. Okay.
Yeah, he kind of said a few times that he was a young man, probably in that age range. He was, so say, let's say 10 to 12, somewhere around there. And he was sleeping, and hears him being called and runs to Eli and says, I'm you called me, I came. And Eli's like, I didn't call you, go back to sleep. And several times, and then says, next time say, here I am, Lord, your servant is listening.
This has always been one of my favorite readings. I don't even know why. I really like it.
Well, the funny thing is as a parent, like, I identify with Eli in this one. Like, daddy, what? Go back to bed. Why are you waking me up?
I did not call you. I promise you I did not call you.
I heard you. You called me. Didn't call you. I'm sleeping. I don't want you in here. Go back to bed. Okay.
So what jumped out at me as I was reading this last night was a couple of things. One, he is sleeping in the temple of the Lord where the Ark of God was.
That's the first verse.
Right. And I really, that sense of he's sleeping in God's presence, like near God. And my mental image is like, there's the Ark and there is his. I know he's not like literally sleeping in the same room
in
as the
Holy
Ark.
Of Holies. No.
But, and yet at the sense, that's how the scene is being set for us, is to think of Samuel sleeping and to think of the Ark of the Lord. God is present to him. And yet when God calls him, he does not recognize God's voice.
Right. His first thought is, it must be Eli calling me, not that God, who is present here in the Ark, is calling me.
Right. So, and in fact, it kind of says, for he was not familiar with God. In another translation I was looking at, it said he had no knowledge of God.
And yet he was.
And yet he's been living in the temple since the age he was weaned when his mother brought him. And yet he has no knowledge of God.
Because the Lord had not revealed anything to him yet. Remember, this is the time before baptism. So he, at baptism, we receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit dwells within us, like the Spirit dwelling
in the
Holy of Holies, in the Shekinah glory, in that space. The ancient Jewish understanding was that the Holy Spirit in the temple dwelled in that space where the four wingtips of the angels on the top of the ark came together.
Man, that always gives me like shivers,
right?
Like thinking about that like spot. That's God's throne, is like that space.
Little space right in between, which is tiny. And yet God lives there.
But again, that kind of like the God is the God of like small things. He's the still small voice that speaks to Elijah. He's like, yeah, small.
He's not little in the rocks crashing, or he's the small, the still quiet voice. Right. And so Samuel had not yet received the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. You know, when he would be anointed as a prophet, then he would have that indwelling, but he had not yet received that until this point.
Right. It also, there's also this great moment where then he goes back to sleep. And in this translation, the one we heard at Mass, it says the Lord came and revealed his presence. But I was looking at a different translation last night, and I'm afraid I can't tell you what translation it was. But the translation I was reading said the Lord stood by him.
Hmm.
And it was this great, like, almost visual image. Like, standing is something that we do who are embodied. Like, it's a very right. physical presence. And the idea of the Lord coming and he's really present there to Samuel suddenly. Like, even though he's in the temple with the ark, suddenly now God is present and reveals his presence to him. He's God who is with him. Which is really Emmanuel, right? God right. is with us.
God with us, right.
So now suddenly this is God who is with him, who is revealing his presence to him.
Right. And calls him three times, by the way. Three, which is, the numbers are always significant.
Right.
And calls him. And Eli finally figures it out. He finally clears the cobwebs from his brain. He wakes up enough to understand, okay.
It's God.
Yes, go to sleep. He understood the Lord was calling the youth. So go to sleep. If you're called, reply, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And then he's called. He grew up and the Lord was with him, not permitting any word of his to be without effect. And it's interesting here. He just says, speak, for your servant is listening. But we don't hear
God says to him.
Right. There's nothing. It's just, and then Samuel grew up. Like, there's, it's almost anticlimactic. You know, there's this big moment. Okay, I've responded to you. What next?
Whatever it was between God and Samuel, and it's not the message wasn't for us.
Right.
It was a personal call. It wasn't
what's important to, well, no, but it was both a personal right. call and a
but what's important call. But what's important is that he was called, not
well, the what's important is that he grew up and became a prophet.
Right.
But what's important for us to know. But the rest of it is for him and between him and the Lord. And that pairs with the gospel, which is Jesus calling Peter and John, or Peter and Simon. Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter. Yes.
Well, it says that there are two disciples of John, and it doesn't really actually name the other guy.
It's John.
Does it?
It's understood to be John. So John, it's John and Andrew, John the Evangelist.
John the Evangelist.
So this is the gospel of John. And so John the Baptist
okay.
was standing with two of his disciples, Andrew and John the Evangelist. That's understood.
And then Andrew goes and gets Peter.
Right, because often John will speak of himself in the third person and not name himself.
Right, he does that a lot.
The disciple that Jesus loved. Yeah.
It's sort of a humility thing.
Yeah. And yeah, Jesus and the disciple he loved.
Wait. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, behold the Lamb of God, which is, Father talked a little bit about the significance of declaring the Lamb of God. The Lamb of God was the sacrifice in the temple.
And the idea of the son who substituted for the son that God didn't demand,
Abraham and Isaac. Yes. Although that was a ram caught in the bushes, but similar.
Sheep.
Close enough.
Sheep, ram.
Yes. A sacrificial animal. Yes.
God will provide the sacrifice, is what Abraham tells Isaac.
I like this interesting moment. Is they say to Jesus, Rabbi, teacher, where are you staying? And Jesus says, come and you will see. And it's a very prosaic sort of thing, but it's come and you will see. Is he answering their question about where are you staying? Or is he, this is the call. Come with me, follow me, and you will see. Your eyes will be opened. You will have understanding.
Well, also, where is he staying? Where he wants to stay is sort of like with Samuel. He wants to stay with them.
Right.
Come, you'll see me being with you. You'll see me staying with you.
Right. So they went and they saw where Jesus was staying and they stayed with him that day. Like, right. He was with them. That's where he was staying.
Also, our second reading, St. Paul tells the Corinthians, right?
The second, yes, Corinthians.
That your temple, your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. So we've also got the sense of like God's presence, God staying with us. So you got Samuel in the temple and then our bodies as the temple and then Jesus coming and staying with the apostles.
Yeah. The second reading is one of the more frustrating readings for me because of the translation. Let me look it up here because what you all probably heard at Mass today was the body is not for immorality, but for the Lord.
Actually what we heard was the body is not for immortality, which was a really, really bad.
Well, what I heard was the body is not for morality. I think to me, it sounded like he swallowed.
I heard mortality.
Yeah. So, 1 Corinthians 6:13. I'm looking up the RSV version. Just to get the translation. Oh, it's the same. It uses the same thing. The body. So the word that is there is it's there. What they're not saying is sexual immorality is what the body is not for. And now it makes sense. Like the body's not for immorality. Well, thanks, Captain Obvious. Yeah, but no. What he's saying is. You know, avoid immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body. Wait, like, aren't all sins immoral? Like, it's confusing, and I wish there was a different translation that where they could say something, avoid licentiousness, or if there was a word that they could use that would protect the innocence of the children, because they could use certain words that might shock. But if there was a word they could use that would protect the innocence of children, but yet get the message clearly across. I suppose they're just leaving it up to the pastor, you know, the homilist or, you know, whoever to make it clear what's being talked about.
Right.
But the point you're making is that we're still approaching this idea of the temple in the first reading where Samuel is sleeping and the Lord is present, the temple where Jesus is the sacrifice and he's calling Peter and Andrew and John to follow him. And now the temple of the body. And the calling that we have, our body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. You have been, you know, therefore glorify God in your body. We are called to be, this is, so all of these readings are about being called by the Lord to something greater, something higher, something better, something holier.
I have to say, though, what strikes me with the first reading, especially, is that sense of like, God calling Samuel, and yet Samuel's not really sure that what he's hearing, he isn't aware that what he's hearing is God. Like,
you have to discern.
Right.
And often that discernment requires the assistance of the church, of
right.
others.
Somebody else, like, God may be calling you, and you're hearing him, and you're hearing...
But you're not sure.
But you don't know... who it is that's calling you. Like, it sounds right. like something
Or you're not sure
external.
if it's in your own head.
Right.
Is God really calling me to this?
Was I dreaming?
Or is it my wishful thinking? Or discernment is a process that often requires the assistance of the church or others or spiritual director or whomever, but that is very hard to do in some cases on your own. That's another good point. So that was, I mean, it's really great readings this week. I mean, it's always great readings, but these were really seemed to be fruitful for us this week to go through. And so it was good to discuss this with you guys. I think we should wrap things up there.
Yeah, it's getting late.
We'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including George S., Kimberly P., Aaron C., Stephen F., and Father Christopher V. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. Now is a great time to become a StarQuest patron. Thanks to a generous gift from a StarQuest supporter, when you start a new Patreon monthly pledge at sqpn.com/give, the first 3 months will be matched by an equal amount from our donor. So if, for example, you became a new patron at $10 a month, after 3 months, our donor will give $30 to StarQuest to support all our shows, including this one, making your gift go even further. So if you've been thinking of becoming a StarQuest patron, now is the time. Visit sqpn.com/give today. So that's from us. We'd love to hear from you and what your insights are, what you have to think about our discussion. If you know any good sea shanties, you can let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And we'll put links to the various things we talked about in our show notes, including that link to the book Melanie mentioned, on our show notes at sqpn.com. If you can, we haven't had one in a long time, but if you get a chance, if you could go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from and write a review of the show, that really helps a lot to get other people to want to listen to the show. It boosts the algorithm and shares the podcast with other people like yourself. And if you directly share the podcast with your friends on social media or just directly, that helps us grow our community of listeners, and that's always good for us and good for you. So until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.